All right, hello, hello, hello. So this is Thus Spoke Zarathustra by Friedrich Nietzsche, and I am going to give you a rundown on exactly what he was talking about in this book, because I've been diving into it quite a lot recently. Oh, Mr. Anil, how are you doing, sir? Let's see, most internal destruction. Mr. Mike, what's the crack? I've been obviously setting up that AI version of Zarathustra's prologue. So I was thinking of just doing a breakdown on what I think of the various parts of the book at the start in order to get the grip on what naughty, nasty Nietzsche is trying to say in all this stuff. So without further ado, because I guess this is going to be recorded, I'll keep it nice and snazzy, and then we can start talking about questions later as people pop in. I'm going to dive into Zarathustra's prologue. So Zarathustra begins with him being 30 years old, and he leaves his house and he runs up into the mountain to become an incel, which I think is such a brilliant start. You think about Nietzsche and you're like, how is he so perfect for our age? Because you obviously have all these very surreal things happening right now. The fall of Christianity is one. Nietzsche talked about that an awful lot. The arrival of this last man, as he said. All these incredible concepts that he was talking about like 100 years ago. And on top of that as well, he's sort of like the first ever internet online dude running around. Like, he's sort of characteristic of this biohacker who's running around the mountains trying to straighten out his health and stuff like this. And all these things that you see people doing so much nowadays, such as looking into like supplements and all this. And like, Nietzsche was experimenting with that stuff. He used to take drugs as well and all sorts of crazy things. So he's very much suited to our age in a very strange way, very, very ahead of his time, as I'm sure you've heard before. So Zarathustra is representative of this. He retreats into the mountain to become a wise man. And he goes into his spirit and his solitude for 10 years. And he's basically like a battery absorbing all the vitality of the world around him. And I think this is a pretty big theme, because as I was piercing through this, trying to transform it into a performative piece, if you will, I'm obviously thinking deeply about all the ideas. And so the whole idea about Zarathustra is that he's actually a really like happy, comedic, joyful character. You'll see this in the second section, which is the when he meets this saint, this hermit and all this. And I think what's really important about this is that there's this constant feeling nowadays, you'll notice, of this like black-pilled feeling. You've heard that before. And this depressing attitude towards the outlook of the world. And it's like the New World Order is going to get us, and Schwab's going to make us all eat bugs, and it's all going to all be depressing. And so it becomes very, we're all very jaded. We're very jaded about the modern world. We're very jaded about life. And Nietzsche and Zarathustra have this lofty attitude, this idea that you must escape that depressing feeling. That depressing feeling is ultimately a sign of weakness, is what he would say an awful lot. And Nietzsche had a way different energy that he was trying to capture, where you escape the kind of the mob, the problems of mankind, and you go up into the mountains where you can start to deal with problems that are far bigger than just the kind of pettiness of the day to day. And you start to develop an awful lot more of a positive attitude. You become lighter. You escape gravity the higher you go up into the mountains. And your loftiness and your spirit gets bigger. And your attitude then becomes bigger as well. And this is sort of what Zarathustra does. He runs into the mountains and he separates himself sort of misanthropically from mankind and becomes juicy. He absorbs the vitality of the world around him and becomes a badass, becomes juicy, becomes filled with, he no longer copes. He overcomes cope is really what's going on. Now, what's really cool about this is that he, like, if you want to think about it in our age, you can imagine the way that we all sit here on the internet and we're complaining about I guess incel them, or people not having, you know, having real relationships anymore and all this type of stuff, and we're worried about Schwab getting us to eat the bugs and all this. And these are all like very real problems, but quite small problems. This is the problems of our own interpersonal social relationships and stuff like this. And then you can kind of wind out of it a little bit and say to yourself, like, what is the, who are the people who are thinking over the course of like 20, 30 years in our culture? Like, for example, OpenAI. Elon Musk, I guess, is a good model. OpenAI dropped ChatGPT. And like, all those AI things came out in the last couple of months. And they've obviously been built for years. And that's a sign of people who were kind of pondering the future for quite a long time. Even Bitcoin is, you know, like 15 years old. And these are much longer timeframes than what the internet has gotten us accustomed to listen to. And so many of the people involved with those projects are really acting on a much bigger timescale, a much slower and more precise, a more intentional timescale than an awful lot of the kind of thoughts that many of us have, which is very short term. You know, we're getting caught up in the dramas of the day, as we said. And many of the people I find who tend to be very pessimistic on black pill tend to be much more short term thinkers. They're much more worried about the immediate present, and they're much more depressed about what's going on. And they find it very, very hard to think in terms of like trends and generations and decades, because that's a different level of thinking. And first, and also the kind of depressing thing about it is that many of the fruits of those big trends, you won't be able to yield until you're much older, and you'll have like less youth and less vitality and all these types of things. So this attitude of being able to go up into the heights, ignore all the kind of squabbling and the stuff that goes on with the people who are, you know, down the mob, if you will, allows you access to this much more positive white pilled perspective, the perspective of looking far into the distance and thinking bigger. And so this is what Zarathustra is all about on that first level. So the book begins with that energy. He goes up into his spirit in the solitude, and he, for 10 years, for a decade, he absorbs the vitality off the world. But eventually his heart changes. And rising one morning with the rosy dawn, he goes before the sun and he says to it, and this is such a beautiful line, "You great star, what would your happiness be if you had nobody to shine for? For 10 years you have climbed up to my cave, and you would have got tired of your light and of the journey had it not been for me and my serpent and my eagle standing here awaiting you every morning to greet you. We received from you your overflow, and we thanked you for it. But now I am weary of my wisdom. I'm a bee that has gathered too much honey, and I need hands outstretched to take it. I would shine like you, go down and distribute it among the people until the wise have become once more joyous in their folly and the poor happy in their riches. I must descend into the deep and, like you, in the evening, go down beneath the sea and give light to the underworld. I must go down. So bless me then, you tranquil eye. You can behold even the greatest happiness without envy. Bless the cup that is about to overflow. This cup is again going to empty itself, and Zarathustra is again going to be a man. Thus began Zarathustra's downgoing." So there's so much in this that's brilliant, but again, it's painting this picture that I was talking about at the start there, that Zarathustra, he's almost like Zarathustra's depressed, he's got fatigued, he's jaded, he's lived till 30 years old in the world, and he's, you know, gone about his ups and downs and tried to deal with the pettiness of being involved in society. And then he says, yeah, fuck it. And he goes up into the mountains, and every morning he's like, you know, he's like Solbra there every morning, going up there, and he suns his balls every morning until his balls are so full of fucking light and juice that he's just full. He's just done. He's like, I can't sun my balls anymore. They're like, you know, they're brown, they're tanned as they can. I must go down and give some of this vitality and energy back to the world. So he's almost like he's charged himself up. He's lifted himself above the mob, and now he's become full of vitality. He's reinvigorated his vril, and now he's going to descend down back out of the mountains into the mob, into the fallen world of mankind, and he's going to give them some of this energy. He's almost like it's like this, the cycle of water, you know, when you go out into the oceans and then the sun makes the water evaporate and it goes up into the skies and it moves through that cycle, then it rains and goes back into the water. It's very similar with energy. You have the mob, and the mob runs out of energy and becomes all depressed and black-pilled. And then you need characters like Zarathustra to go up into the mountains, to sun their balls, to become full of vitality, and then bring that vitality back down and white-pill the people. And so this is a huge theme in this. And Nietzsche's writing this, it's almost like a joke, because it's a little bit of like a parody of the wise man and the character of the wise man. But this is sort of part of the parody, you know. He's some kind of lofty dude who's like super white pill, super positive, going down, and he's here to bring good vibes to the people. He's here to bring the gospel to the people, if you want to think about it this way. And so that becomes section one of Zarathustra's downgoing. He receives the energy from the sun. He says such brilliant things. about how he's going to overflow and pour all his vitality out into the people. And he begins this metaphor now of going down into the deep. He goes down into the mob, down into the people. And this is a really, really big idea. If you know an awful lot about Nietzsche's philosophy, you'll hear an awful lot about Dionysus and the descent. And I'll talk about this as we go forward through Zarathustra. But that ends the first section. And you know what? I'm going to pop in here and see. Oh, geez, we have a couple of more people in here. So if anybody has any thoughts or any ponderings on what I was suggesting here, what I was reading out here, I'd love to hear any questions or all this type of stuff. So before we go on to section two, Mr. Briggs requested. How are you, sir? Mr. Briggs, if you've got any, how are you doing, sir? I'm afraid I cannot hear you, sir. No, look. Hello, Mr. Briggs. I can hear. Sounds like you're driving a car or something like that, giving us an ambient background track to the space. Oh, a little bit. It's quite faded, but I can hear it. All right, Mr. Briggs, I might bounce into section two then. And as you play around with the mic, I will. We can maybe talk after that one. How's that sound? Yeah, these tech difficulties. All right. We'll suss that out. If anybody else has any ponderings, any questions, you better go quick because I'm going to go on an autistic rant now and again. So you just better be ready. All right, request otherwise. All right, sweet. We're going. All right, this is back in. Zarathustra Part 2. Are you ready, motherfuckers? So Zarathustra... What was that? Jesus Lord. Anyway, Zarathustra Part 2 decides to go down, as we said, into the world. This is his big thing. So he's sort of saying, all right, I'm going to go down. I'm going to deal with the normies. I'm going to deal with the mob. I've sunned my balls like Solbra. I am now juiced to the fucking gills. I'm going to go down and I'm going to start flexing with the people, get them more white-pilled, get them more hyped, tell them to stop being depressed fucks, being black-pilled, and spending all their days on 4chan, basically. So he goes down the mountain, but on his way down the mountain, he comes across a saint. Now, this is a bit of an issue because the saint is a representation of the priest, a sort of representation of Christianity. Now, this is a very interesting passage, part two. And I remember when I was trying to construct the visual narrative, it kind of shocked me. It kind of clicked with me in my head what was going on. Because Nietzsche's unconscious is trying to paint the saint, the Christian, the man of knowledge as a misanthrope, as someone who's jaded, as someone who hates mankind. Now, that seems quite strange because we often have a different perspective. We think Nietzsche is some type of like crazy hater of the world, nihilist and all this. But here he's presenting Zarathustra as the sort of lofty, happy, go-lucky character. And this saint that he meets as this jaded, depressed, anti-mankind character. And I'll get into this as I read through this section and whatnot. But that's a pretty significant theme. This character, the saint, is pessimistic. He is black-pilled. This character, the saint, he was somebody who used to work in the church. He used to work in his village. He was a wise man. He's actually the same as Zarathustra. He'd be very representative of Nietzsche or maybe Nietzsche's dad or something like this. The man of knowledge who is the shepherd who guides the flock, who teaches the people their morality and stops them getting cooked by leftism and stuff like this. And then what happens is this priest, this saint, whatever he is, he becomes jaded with his people and he decides to leave the fucking bullshit, the mob, the same mob that Zarathustra escaped. But instead of going all the way up to the top of the mountain and sunning his balls and becoming full of vitality and getting the serpent and eagle and all that stuff and becoming fucking flex mob mode or whatever, this saint goes and becomes a hermit in the mountain and lives in the forest. And actually, Zarathustra passed him on the way up. And so this is a representative of a more of an escapist path where this saint is like the old monk. In Ireland, we have these like rocks off the coast of Kerry where they're basically just like a rock that you would fit one house on them or something like this. And there's all these old stone houses from the medieval eras where these monks used to go out and just live in these rocks because they'd be like, fuck people, man. People are shit. Fuck people completely. I'm going to go out and I'm going to stay with God. I'm going to eat fish. And I'm going to grow maybe a couple of little plants in this little tuft. And then I'm gonna chill, man. I'm gonna live out here by myself. And this is the hermit, the escaper, you know, this is the dude going out into isolation and whatnot. And so this is what this saint sort of represents. And Zarathustra is very much the same character, but has a way different energy. He's not jaded at all. And we wonder why. Maybe he's taking enough supplements. That could be it. So a reading from second part of Zarathustra. Zarathustra went down the mountain alone, and he met nobody. But when he entered the forest, there suddenly stood before him an old man who had left his holy cot to seek roots. And so Zarathustra spoke to the old man. Oh, sorry, no. The old man spoke to Zarathustra. Fucking phraseology and Nietzsche acting like a pompous brick. Anyway, the old man said to Zarathustra, "No stranger to me is this wanderer. Many years ago, you passed me by. Zarathustra was your name, but you have changed. Back then, you carried ashes into the mountains, but now you carry fire into the valleys. But don't you fear that you might lose your fire in the valleys? Yes, I recognize you, Zarathustra. Your eyes are pure. There is no hate lurking around your mouth. You're even going and walking like you were dancing. You have changed, Zarathustra, a child you have become, an awakened one. But what will you do in the land of those who sleep? You lived eternally in the ocean of solitude, and it has lifted you up and filled your spirit. And now you choose to go ashore. What are you dragging your body to the mob for?" And then Zarathustra basically answers and says, "Well, I love the mob. I love mankind." And the saint says, "What, you fucking idiot? Why? Why do you think I went into the forest and the desert? I loved mankind too, but I loved them too much. They weren't good enough. Now I love God. Men I do not love. Man is a thing too imperfect for me. To love man would be fatal to me." And Zarathustra replies, "Well, when I spoke of love, I'm not doing this because I'm expecting man to give me something to validate me. When I spoke of love, I want to bring gifts to men." And then the saint gets mad and he says, "Don't give them anything. Take instead part of their load. Carry it along with them. Help them. That would be something that they enjoy. But if you want to give something to them, give them nothing more than charity and make sure that they beg for it." But Zarathustra replied, "No, I'm not here to give charity. I'm too poor for that." And the saint and Zarathustra laughed. That was Zarathustra cracking a joke. You know, he's fucking vital mog inflection. He's cracking jokes and everything. So the saint laughed at Zarathustra. And then he said, "We'll see to it that they accept your gifts. They are distrustful of wise men like ourselves. They don't believe that we come with gifts. When they hear our footsteps, they think that we are thieves." Who's just fucking farting? What's going on? All right, I'm gonna have to boot people if you're gonna be farting on the mic. Like, what the hell? We're trying to be all serious and fucking read Zarathustra here. Like, Jesus Christ. Anyway, "Go among the men that stay in the forest, rather go to the animals. But why not be like me, a bear among bear, a bird among..." Yeah, right. So here we are. So the wise men say they're all gonna be thieves. And then he says, "Don't go to men, stay with me in the forest." So this is the old man, the saint talking. "Don't go to men, stay with me in the forest. Go rather to the animals. Why not be like me, a bear among the bear, a bird among the birds?" And then Zarathustra says, "What the fuck do you do in this forest then? How do you spend your days?" And the saint answers, "I make hymns and I sing them. And in making hymns, I laugh and I weep and I mumble. Thus do I praise God. With singing, weeping, laughing and mumbling, do I praise God, the God who is my God. But what do you bring as a gift?" And this is actually another joke. So he's basically saying, you know, "Zarathustra, if you're going to be bringing gifts, you better give me a fucking gift." And then Zarathustra says, "Oh, shit. Well, what do I have to give you? I'd better hurry and go on my way. I don't want to take anything from you and your perfect life." So they're, like, again, joking with each other. They're having a bit of a laugh. And then the old man Zarathustra laughs and they walk off. And as Zarathustra is walking away, he finally walks until he is alone. And he says to his heart, "Could it be possible this old saint who lives in the forest has not yet heard that God is dead?" And that ends section 2. Now, there's a lot there. Maybe I could break down into it more. I don't want to rant too much. I'd love to hear if anybody has any thoughts or ponderings. But as I said, I think the core to that, when I was like sort of deep reading this, trying to figure out the visual narrative, is I saw that really strong dichotomy between the saint and the saint's misanthropy, the saint's hate for mankind, the saint's depression with the state of mankind, mankind's incompetence, mankind's failures. And man, like the saint obviously has the ideals of religion and the ideals of philosophy and like Platonism, where we would like to believe that man is better than he is, but man lets us down. It's like all of us today, you know, we're sort of like getting red pilled on the state of the world. And we go out and we talk to normies and they're like, you know, they're like, they've literally got a shrine built in, you know, we've all become post-religious, rational people in the modern world, but then you go and meet your normie auntie or something like that, and she's got a shrine built to Fauci in her fucking house or something like that, and you're like, oh man, I can't deal with these people. Like, what the fuck is going wrong with this world? And you become sort of like that saint. You're like, I can't save them. I'm done. I'm not going to try to save these fuckers anymore. It's over. And I think Zarathustra is representative of a different energy. It's like Zarathustra is so abundant and vital that he can actually accept man's imperfection. And he can accept that man is a raw piece of clay to be crafted that is not perfect. And Zarathustra can accept that he is the force that will perfect them. He will be the force that brings them gifts, that will bring them a path. He will not give up on man. In fact, he loves man because he loves man for his potential. And he'll get to this later in this brilliant passages later on. Whereas the saint is the jaded motherfucker who's like, oh, fuck these dudes. I'm done. I can't change them. You know, that's that despair. This is a really big theme in this, where you've got this weakness of will who can't enact transformation upon mankind. It's the spirit inside all of us where we say, I won't be able to psyop my auntie to stop worshipping Fauci. I can't do it. So you give up. You give up on mankind. You give up on the people. And that's your weakness inside of you that's giving up on them because you don't have it in you. And that's a really human emotion. It's not to say that, like, you know, this is actually legitimately a difficult problem. But Zarathustra is this, you know, godlike figure who does not have this problem. He's above this. He's the lofty one, the one who has sunned his balls. He's the eternal soul bra, and he's come down. And then, of course, there's this question of God is dead and stuff like this. And this is, I think, very much related to this idea of the we would call it idealism. You know, the old man who becomes jaded with mankind escapes into the forest and spends all his time unifying himself with God and harmony in the world. And this is his escape from the challenge that sits in front of us, which is the shoddy state of man, as Nietzsche is going to call him, the last man later. And Zarathustra's bit of a black pill for the saint is that even though he's escaped into the forest, that God that he's worshipping is not really what he thinks it is. And it's kind of been lost to him. You know, what we need to do is we need to actually take that energy we want to unify with perfection in God. That's what you're doing in the forest, singing hymns and doing all these pretty things. You want to actually take that energy and try bring it to the problem in front of you, which is mankind as it is, which is the present world, instead of trying to escape. And that's like sort of what we mean by God is dead. It's a bit more complicated than that, but I guess that's my best approximation. All right. Before I go into section three, is there any ponderings and questions? Anybody would like to ask anything? Anybody want to drop thoughts or comments? Hughes must absolutely adore my ranting. Nobody wants to come in and subvert the chat or something like this, no? All you have to do is request. If not, I will keep going. The autistic rant. All right, bro. I'm definitely going to have to just boot you if I can figure out how. All right, let's go on to the next one. If anybody wants to request before I go, any ponderings, any questions? Yeah, right. Looks like you are going to get it. So this next section, I absolutely love this next section. This next section is the introduction of the Übermensch. All right, and so this is where Zarathustra arrives in the village, and he finally. So he's after leaving the old man. So he starts up with the sun. He suns his balls. He becomes vital. He takes his soul sups. He takes his magnesium, whatever it is. He becomes juicy. He goes down into the forest. He meets a jaded saint, you know, who's become black-pilled, been on 4chan too much, has gave up on the people. And now he goes past him and he says, all right, well, look, I'm bringing a new vibe around here. And so he continues walking down, and now he arrives at the village. He arrives at the village, and he is past the old man. He is now arriving at the people, the subject, the focus of his message. He's coming to bring them information about the transformation. He's the prophet of the lightning, coming to tell them about the future, tell them about what's going on. He's been up in the mountains, and he's kind of got a sus on the big problems in the world, on the state of man and what needs to happen. And he's come down now, and he's going to begin to preach to these people like an old school prophet, you know. And this is very much like a sort of a parody of biblical prophets and whatnot. And so at this point, he's here to present the Übermensch. And so many interesting themes come up in this that I, like when I was going through it visually, it's actually very shocking, you know, because you read through it and he has all these concepts that are very much like in alignment with certain parts of many of our modern myths, but it's almost like a more based version of them. So for example, if you think about the typical layout of the cultural paradigm, you have the libtards, you know, and you have these people, they believe in climate change and they believe in veganism and they believe in, you know, Hail Greta Thunberg, and they have all these types of concepts and they have wokeism and all this stuff. And we have then a very, very loose, unconscious reaction to all this. And this is the people who are dissenting against this. And they form, and like you maybe you could say the conservatives are part of this, and they form a sort of identity based on not liking the woke, not liking climate change, not liking these type of things. They feel all that stuff is a scam and they don't like it. But this reaction does not have a first principled stance or belief. The best among them are the staunch Christians who actually believe in their religion. They are the people who are standing on a foundation that is very, very deep. But the majority of them are not even that. You know, majority of them are just sort of like political conservatives, as characters like, I think it's, I can't remember who it was who said it, but they basically say, like, conservatism is leftism with a speed limit, you know, with a handbrake on or something like this. And so you have this sort of problem where this reaction to this paradigm of all these giant myths for our people. Maybe I'll try to double stress that because this is a pretty big one. We all live within dreams, within hopes for the future, within big ideas, stuff like this. Our people have religious myths that dictate and decide our minds and decide the great things that we're going to do. When a kid goes into college, he doesn't want to believe that he's going to become someone boring, especially a creative, idealistic kid. He wants to believe that he's changing the world. He wants to believe that he's going to work for Elon Musk and they're going to develop artificial intelligence. He wants to believe that he's going to go and work alongside Elon Musk and develop the electric car that solves climate change. These big dreams is what matters. If you grew up in 1,000 years ago in the medieval world, and you were a knight, you would be dreaming about going for the church and fighting against the Muslims. That was the big crusade, to go on the Reconquista or to go down to Jerusalem. That was the great big dream that was inside of your mind. If you were participating in the 19th century, you would have dreamed about being an engineering scientist that would have created a new industrial machine or something like this. So these myths are extremely important for the direction of our culture. These are the big stories. And right now, the myths that dominate our culture are, as we would say, the sort of Reddit myths of climate change, of all these types of things, of wokeism, of like, what is the world going to? Think about the story that's being told. We, via capitalism, have become super powerful and we've overproduced and turned ourselves into McDonald's consuming fat chungus dorks who are ruining the world. So we need to temper all that in the West and stop our consumption and our carbon production and go over to electric cars and become sustainable so that we can protect the Earth, because the Earth is sacred and we don't want to damage it. Now, it's actually not a very incoherent story. It's a very good story, you know, and this is something that's quite interesting. Now, of course, a part of that has become politicized, where there's people like who are going to try to do carbon credit cards and all this soy shit. So a lot of people react against it. But that's a big issue, because they don't have a story to answer that very well. And then there's all these other ones, like we're going to transform the world into the globalized world where there will be no centralized governments, and we're all going to be like, everybody's going to immigrate everywhere else, and we're all going to blend into this mishmash, this, like, you know, amorphous blob consciousness, and we'll be ruled over by usurious financiers, and we'll all like have sex in gay bars, and that'll be, you know, that'll be the future. Hey, you know, Hail Fauci, this type of thing. We'll all be vaxxed, all be like doing all this type of stuff. And this dream is actually about latching onto the inevitable progress of globalism. And these are all monstrously big stories, super huge stories. And an awful lot of the people who don't like them, do they have a better answer? Like, I think this is a big question. On the first principle, the Earth, for example, is getting fucked up by humanity. Do we have a good enough counter narrative to that? Because if you just say, I don't like carbon credit cards and I don't like people telling me I want to drive electric cars, you probably need a bit better story than that, though. Do you have a whole comprehensive alternate perspective that is going to say, how are we going to save the Earth and make sure that the Earth and life is going to win in the Earth? And actually, and this is really what Nietzsche does very well, he has a perspective that has that. His entire perspective could be described as pro-nature. It's pro-life in its fundamental level, which means that there's this sort of unity with humanity and nature on a fundamental level, and about humanity developing a moral outlook that is in alignment with nature and harmonized with nature. All of these things work with this, that actually gives this very, very powerful perspective that would allow things like, you could maybe call it, you know, environmentalism, but not soy. You know, it'd be like what you see an awful lot of people forming now, saying stuff like, maybe if we ran better, more sustainable farming practices, we'd all be able to eat like steak and have better food and stuff like this, but we wouldn't have to all eat soy and drive stupid electric cars that are whatever the fuck is going on, like all these type of things. So this is a very, very, very big question. And you see an awful lot through his speech here that he constantly lays down principles that you will recognize as the New World Order using in their narratives. But in some sense, the reaction trying to throw those narratives out without realizing the power of those narratives. So I am going to read this now. We'll dive into it. So when Zarathustra, number three, when Zarathustra arrived at the nearest town which adjoined the forest, he found many people assembled in the marketplace. For it had been announced that a rope dancer, tightrope walker, was going to give a performance. And so Zarathustra stood out in front of them all and decided to take this opportunity to speak to the people. And so he stood up and he said, "Dear people, I am here to teach you about the Übermensch. Man is something that is to be overcome. What have you done to overcome him? All beings up till now have created something beyond themselves. Do you want to be the end of that great tide? Would you rather go back to the beast than overcome man? Because what is an ape to man? He is a laughingstock, a thing of shame. And just the same is what will be the Übermensch. What man will be to the Übermensch, a laughingstock, a thing of shame. You have made your way from worm to man, but there is much within you that is still worm. Once you were apes, even yet man is more of an ape than any of the apes. Even the wisest among you is only a disharmony and a hybrid of plant and phantom. But do I bid you become phantom or plants? No. I teach you of the Übermensch. The Übermensch is the meaning of the earth. Let your will say that the Übermensch will be the meaning of the earth. I conjure you, my brothers, remain faithful to the earth and do not believe in those who speak to you of otherworldly hopes. Poisoners are they, whether they know it or not. They despise life. They are decaying and spiteful themselves, and the earth is weary of them, so let them go. It was once blasphemy against their God that was the greatest blasphemy, but then God died, and therewithin also their blasphemy. The greatest sin now is to blaspheme the earth, to rate the heart of the unknowable higher, to rate the heart of the unknowable higher than the meaning of the earth. Once the soul looked contemptuously on the body, and then that contempt was a supreme thing. The soul wished the body disgusting, sickly, famished. It taught to escape the body and the earth. But the soul itself was ugly, ghastly, and famished. And its cruelty is what delighted it. Its hate for the body is what stimulated it. So, my brothers, what does your body say about your soul? Is your soul not poverty and pollution and wretched self-hate and laziness? You see, man is a polluted stream. You must be a sea to receive this polluted stream without becoming impure. Oh, I teach you of this, the Übermensch. He is that sea. In him can your great hatred be submerged. What is the greatest thing you can experience? It is the hour of your greatest contempt, the hour in which even your happiness becomes disgusting to you, and also your reason, and also your virtue. The hour when you say, what good is my happiness? It is poverty and pollution and wretched self-complacency. My happiness should justify existence itself. It is the hour when you say, what good is my reason? Does it long for knowledge as the lion longs for his food? It is poverty and pollution and a wretched self-complacency. The hour when you say, what good is my virtue? It has not made me passionate. How weary am I of my good and my bad? It is all poverty and pollution and a wretched laziness. Have you ever spoken like this? Have you ever cried like me? If only I have heard you crying like this. But instead you sit on your knees crying up to heaven. But where is the lightning that licks you with its tongue? Where is the frenzy which enchants you? I teach you the Übermensch. He is that lightning. He is that frenzy. And then when Zarathustra had said all this, someone stood up and laughed at him, sniggered. All right, nice one, brother. We have heard enough about this tightrope walker. That's a very good speech, but maybe you can be quiet and then we can see him. And all the people gaggled and laughed at Zarathustra. But the rope dancer heard this and thought that they were calling for him. So he began his performance. Now, I'm going to try to break this up into three distinct big ideas, because, as I said, there's some absolutely monstrous ones. But I guess this first one is, I teach you the Übermensch, the biggest idea of all, Nietzsche's whole concept manifest. And as I was sort of saying, it's like the myths of our age. We have this libtard left that has this progressive idea about, and we don't understand this because it's so mythically deep that it's unconscious, but we have this idea in our head of this man that we're trying to create. Like, do you know the way people say there's a war on men right now? Oh, like Tate is a great example. Like, there's a war on men. The Matrix is trying to stop you from drinking sparkling water. And he's genuinely listening to his instincts, and his masculine, manly instincts are saying, fight, conquer, win, you know, ambition, succeed, beat everybody else. And then the world around him is promoting this morality of patheticness, of cuckoldry, of castration. It's teaching you to be a compliant, good little tax slave. It's transforming you into a soy boy, a soy jack. This is the purpose of modern morality and modern society. It is an industrial machine to turn you into an efficient worker drone, which is ultimately a soy jack, which can use ChatGPT to write out the Excel sheets for the overlords who don't pay tax. This is what you are. This is what you're getting manifested into. And everything about your life is socialized this way. You go into society, you go into the institution of education, you leave your family, and you do the first big participation in society, which is school. And in school, they make you sit down, and they tell you to shut the fuck up, and they fill you full of Adderall, and they teach you how to read book cope that is useless. And they teach you the myths of the culture. They don't teach you anything about finance, about money, about the nature of power, about very difficult questions. They are now starting to secularize all these schools. If you're unlucky enough to go into school in the recent years, they will teach you that your gender might be in question, and if you say the wrong thing at the wrong time, they might even fill you full of hormones and cut your fucking dick off. This is what the modern education system has become manifest as. This is what this project of modernity is designed to do to man. It is transforming mankind into cattle. And if you're remaining within these institutions, you are getting morphed into something. There is an implicit normal an implicit useful guy that they're trying to create out of these institutions they're trying to build. Contrast this with the Spartans. You go to the Spartan world of the ancient Greeks, and they would literally put you outside to die. And if you were not strong enough, you would get eaten by the wolves on the side of a mountain. They would literally kick you out when you're 14 or something like that. And you would have to go and steal for your food and fend for yourself. And if you got caught, they would punish you and execute you as a part of their judicial system. This was a different type of man. It was a eugenic project to breed supermen, men of warrior capacity that were more dominant and powerful than everybody around them. Contrast that with how we're institutionalized and developed and educated and trained, how our potential is manifest. It is not. Our creative potential, our growth potential, the possibility for us to become what we are, is steered towards transforming us into a good worker, the working man for the modern state, the naive man. Again, Tate is such a brilliant contrast to this, because Tate's basically saying it's a scam. You go and you go and work in your job, and there's people out there like me who don't pay taxes, who have all these financial institutions all across the world, so they're anti-fragile, who do all these things like the elite do, so we don't have to do the same. So you basically work in McDonald's and do our fucking job for us. And this is the big realization of this. It's like, what exactly are all of our moral pretensions and our big ideas and our notions that we tell ourselves and the systems and structures that we put together and all these myths that we tell ourselves about equality and about good and about nice and about all these things, like all everything that we, our entire cultural force, what does it lead to in the end? What type of person does it manifest as? If you see this as this giant operation, this giant art project, what is the output of that art project? And you look around at the average person these days and you see a soy jack and you're like, fuck, that's what it is. That's what's becoming manifest. That's what we're screwing up. That's what is the output of our culture. Maybe there's something wrong. And of course, Nietzsche is trying to sing into existence a different story, a different dream, a different idea. He's trying to sing about this idea of the Übermensch. If you sat down and you said to yourself, what type of world, if I could get into all the subtleties of the modern world, how would I build a more powerful man? How would I create somebody who's like super creative genius? How would I make this world, give this world space for a great person like a Napoleon or like a Beethoven to show up, or a Nietzsche indeed, to show up in this modern world? What would I have to do? What would have to be structured? What would that person have to think? How would this work? Like, what would this look like? What type of stories would we have to be telling? And this would be probably a much different operation, a much more difficult operation to do. How would the education system change? You would actually have to change the education system and build the education system looking for the exceptions instead of trying to turn everybody normal. You would have to be trying to filter out the excellent out of the normal, which is the complete opposite to the way the education system works, you know? And then that kind of runs all the way up through society. Like, how do you build a society designed for the great, the excellent, the strong? It's such a mind-bending thing when you went to think about this stuff. And this becomes the big project, the big idea, the big question, because what future do we have if we spend ten more decades, 100 years, following along this sort of last man path that we're on? What will we have? Like, what will the European people, the Western people be in 50 years if we keep going down the path they're going down? They'll be eating bugs. They'll be like fouched out of their faces. They'll have like their religion will be completely just secularized, mad shit. They'll all be skinny dorks with weak wrist strength and all this, drinking Soylent. It'll be over. There'll be nothing left in us. It'll be done. Whereas if that's in that same amount of time, if you got like a load of like autistic right-wing bodybuilders to get in control of all the education systems and institutions, and they force kids from the age of 5 to be like taking creatine, whey protein and barbell, sunning their balls and lifting weights and reading about Nietzsche and all this type of stuff. Like, what type of psychopathic, super creative Spartan society would you have then in 30 years, 50 years? It would be insane, the difference. It would actually be mind-blowing, the difference, for a litany of different reasons. And that's really the big question, the biggest idea with this Übermensch concept, because it's about the question of the ideal, the goal, because man is the goal. The man that you create is the goal. And morality adapts to that. What is right and wrong? Because that's all that morality is making decisions about what is right and wrong. What is the right decision, the wrong decision? Your decisions transform massively based on your ideal. The ideals that we have in our society, the God that we worship is the God of the soyjack cuck, the good boy, the good compliant man. And all of our morality, well, you can say the libtard morality, is shaped around that. And it's promoted everywhere. The guy who, you know, is super socialized. Like, you're seeing all this stuff nowadays. I think I just saw one recently where the Gillette ad was the perfect example of this, if you remember that back in the day. And it was about the guys, like, always just, like, subverting their instincts. Don't go talk to the girl because that annoys the girl and stuff like this, you know. The kind of counterpoint to all this stuff. And then contrast this then with a different ideal. A different ideal, which is about building a Superman. Like, how does everything change as this consequence? And the last sort of idea that mixes within this is the question of inaction and right action, because this is a process of evolution. You know, man transforms from the ape and he transforms into the next step and he goes from worm to man. And it's a big question because we are always evolving. We're always transforming. We're always becoming something new. Like, look at how much, what's the famous thing about testosterone? Look at how much we have transformed in the last couple of decades. You don't get to make a choice. You're going to transform one way or another. There's no standing still. There's no freezing. There's no going back. There's no denying what's happening. We are always making decisions in whatever direction. And this is what's the key, is that these decisions are going to lead to a result. They're going to lead to us manifesting as something. And so if you just sort of stay in time long enough, you will evolve. But depending on what you decide to put pressure on yourself and how you decide to act, that determines what you're going to evolve into. So if we develop this society of cushions and the metaverse and eating McDonald's, we will devolve into, I shouldn't say devolve, we will transform into that character, into the tub man, the last man, as we would say. But if we stay in evolution and just give it time and start to put all the right systems in place and start to work on ourselves and craft ourselves, over time, you know, the generations will get stronger. Our kids will be more powerful than the last generation. And over time, that could be in an ascendant path if we can really be serious about it. And we will evolve into something higher, something more supreme. We will start to unify with the machines and start to get better understandings of nutrition and improve our longevity and become more intelligent in the way that we operate and organize our cultures and the way that we deal with our strengths and whatnot. And all of this would compound over time to make us more and more and more profound. And basically what would then begin to happen is that the long process of evolution would take its course and you would begin to see the sort of final end of mankind as a unified species and the breaking off of a new species, a kind of step up, you know. And this is going to happen anyway, because what you would see then is that maybe the last man, the soy man, the bug man would kind of stall. He would be unhealthy. They would, you know, they would continue to, their life expectancy would probably drop because they're so full of seed oils. Their IQ would get worse. Their health would get worse. They'd just remain uglier. Epigenetics would start to kick into gear. Like, that's actually quite a serious thing where you can basically, like, eat shitty food your whole life and then your kids will still suffer from it because of the epigenetic load that has been passed on to them. And what you would see then with all this, like, modern biotech and stuff like this is this manifestation of these supermen who would be people who would maybe have access to long-term financial skills and longevity tools that allowed them to live for 140, 150, 200 years. And then they would, like, be networking together and using things like AI in order to work together. And what happens at that point is that you're developing a different race. You're developing a split in the human species where you've got these people who are living on a shorter life cycle, like 70 years, maybe less, who are unhealthy, who have all this compounding of just shockingly bad habits. And you now at this point have this, like, aristocracy, this royalty, that are not just an aristocracy and royalty because of something like status, but they are literally different biologically. They're healthier genetics. They have got much, much better cultural practices, but they're doing things like living longer and whatnot. And at that point, that becomes so uncompetitive that these people essentially branch off and become, like, you know, they just overtake them completely. It's like when apes, you know, the first ape to stand up and start to use a spear. 200 years, 1,000 years later, that ape was basically on its way to being a human, and it was dominating all the other apes. But they began as brothers at the start. So that is the prophecy of the Übermensch. The second question then becomes the question of the Earth, because Nietzsche is also pointing this idea that the Earth is very important. He has some very challenging things for any Christians to suggest that we had in our institutions of the priesthood and stuff like this, despisers of life, he calls them. Now, he has quite a sophisticated philosophy about this, but the simplest way you can understand it is that they, the church and whatnot, was as bad as any liberal institution for enforcing this whole tyranny of the ideal man being a normal, quiet cock in some way. Like, they had a very bad habit of doing that. They to kind of bring someone into the religious operation of a church is to get them to be timid like that. It's to teach them these morals that make them a little bit hesitant and whatnot. And it also sort of gets them to deny life and deny their instincts, deny their passions. Christianity has many of those features within it. And a lot of people like it these days because we live in the kind of porno industry and age where we use our passions too much. And so Nietzsche is sort of suggesting that counter to the idealism of the church and the kind of escapism of all that stuff and those social institutions, you could imagine something that is much more natural, an alignment with the spirit of life, which is what we mean by the spirit of nature, which is what we mean by the spirit of the earth, the will to power inside of us, the will to vitality. You would look at like this, the pagan Spartans, as much more aligned with the earth because their religion is the religion of life. And you look at the way they operated for themselves and they express that stuff more directly. And so when you start to base your philosophy on nature, you start to ask yourself, well, what does nature want? It's actually a very simple idea, because maybe I'm rambling a little bit here, but what does nature want? Well, nature wants the strong, you know? So she wants the creative and the strong. She's always looking for that. Nature rewards the lion with health, vitality, and beauty when it kills the gazelle and dominates it and eats it. It's very brutal, but it's the truth. It rewards the lion with grace when it hurts another animal, when it tortures another animal basically to death and then eats its stomach out while it's still alive. It's horrible. And so nature's ideal, nature's goal is to try to find which animal is most capable, and then it rewards it with health and power. The animal which is most capable of defending itself and conquering all the other animals. And so nature wants this. This is what nature is looking for. And this is very difficult for us because nature's scary. Like, there's no doubt about it. And so Nietzsche is basically saying, remain faithful to the earth. The Übermensch is the meaning of nature, the meaning of earth. If nature has that pregnant desire for this super strong, super creative, super dominant energy, ideal thing, whatever it is, this Übermensch is the manifestation of that. Imagine the most successful entity that has ever existed on the planet, because man is sort of an expression of that. Humankind is an expression of nature's absolute apex of creativity and strength. Like, we're not the we're a representation of like nature's pure will for domination. She actually rewards intelligence and creativity over everything. We're not the strongest animal, we're the smartest animal, and that's why we rule over all the other animals. And so we have this like great energy inside of us, and this is sort of what the Übermensch is the highest expression of that. And then you have an awful lot of people, he would call them despisers of life. They're these people that, like, they manifest in many different ways. I'm not going to get into it too much now. But they would basically be in denial of this urge inside nature. They would think it's evil, and they would try to escape, like the saint beforehand, into, you know, something pretty like the dreams of God or idealism or escapism. And they miss out then on this great project as a consequence. And they make the great mistake of preaching their ideals instead of this one, and they sort of betray nature as a consequence. And so the Übermensch is castigated as something evil and bad, and then we lose out on this great opportunity, and we betray life, and we ultimately become life despisers, as we said. And there's a lot of stuff that he keeps on going through, because I'm ranting so much now, I'm not sure if I want to go through it too much. But basically, he's talking, like, I think one of the most beautiful metaphors here is the idea that, well, he continues down that line where he's saying, these despisers of life developed this, like, so much of what they represented consistently developed into this anti-life philosophy. So you see throughout Christianity And like, it's not just Christianity. Christianity is the Western expression of this. But you see this also in the libtards as well. The hate for the body, the contempt for the body. You see this sort of ugly, golem-like character show up nowadays, which is, you know, the pencil-necked dork who's full of Soylent, who clearly doesn't take any pride in what he is. He doesn't want to be anything of a man or a capable athlete or something like this. He doesn't like the body. He sees it as arrogant. He has a bad relationship with it. He's not like learned how what he is, and he's at war with his nature as a consequence. And he wants to enforce Fauci's vaccines upon you as a consequence, because he doesn't understand that you take better care of his body and you shouldn't be put under the same tyranny as him. And there's sort of those similar problems inside Christianity, where many of these priests who were preaching morality to the herd were the losers. You know, they weren't the cool dudes who were athletic warriors going out and fighting that often. Oftentimes they would have been the sort of book coping nerd who might have been even a little bit effeminate sometimes. Not all of them. Some of them would have been absolute based chads as well. But some of them would have been a little bit like this. And they would have got a grip of a group of people in the village, and they would have spent their time promoting this sort of soy morality. And they would have seen any expressions of life and vitality as very, very bad. And Nietzsche has some very harsh criticisms of Christian culture as an entire consequence because of its hate for the body. And it was quite dramatic. Like, for example, the Olympics was banned when Rome fell and when Rome turned Christian. And it did not get resurrected until the 19th century. And the Olympics is obviously a very soulful expression of love of the body. It's a very Greek pagan attitude. But when Christianity comes in, it bans all this stuff, because it's like, that's, we don't want to see athleticism. We don't want to see the naked bodies. That's how they used to do the Olympics. We don't want to see people scantily dressed. And there's this sort of hate and shame for the body, which is an extension of the hate and the shame for nature. There's this big complaint in early Christianity about iconoclasm, which is like, can we even make art to do with our God? They don't do it in Islam, for example. And the Western church wouldn't allow it. But it was a big topic in the Orthodox Church, much, much bigger problem over there. But the Western Church allowed art. They were like, oh, fuck that, we're not going that far. But the point being is that there is interesting trends which are anti-life imposed in the Christian worldview. Now, again, I don't like people who develop a hate boner for Christianity. You have to be able to see this stuff with nuance. Christianity was a very complex and incredible religion, but that's one side of it. And you see nowadays many of these similar expressions for this anti-life perspective manifest in a completely secular anti-Christian worldview, which is the soy worldview that you see so much. And so Nietzsche's drawing a generalized conception of the anti-life perspective versus the pro-life perspective, which is what he says. And so Christianity, atheist, Jewish, Muslim, Hindu, Buddhist, he don't give a fuck. He's not here developing a hate boner for any of them. He's just pointing out when they are in denial of life, well, that's what's going on there. And so he is big with this. And then lastly, he constantly brings up this idea, and this is a big metaphor that comes up now a lot, which I find very, very beautiful, is these nature metaphors of mankind as some type of natural force, like an ocean. And the problem with the ocean is that it's a stormy ocean. He uses later as well the metaphor of a storm, you know, and what these things represent is the sort of collective will of mankind and the distorted unconscious mob will of mankind. So you look in the world now, you go onto Twitter, like look at all the pain and the suffering that's out there. It's like this ocean of people writing their negative thoughts up in the world. And you're like, Jesus, there's just so much suffering. There's so much pain. And the question, and this is a very serious question, is like, how do people get catharsis for that pain overall? And what you'll eventually find when you dig down into it is that you need a hope, you need a belief, you need an ideal, a God. This is what Christ was. Christ was the Savior, the Messiah, because he came down and he showed people that there's hope for life after death. There's hope for heaven. There's hope to overcome the suffering. Now, Nietzsche would argue some very challenging points and say that was basically a beautiful lie that we told ourselves. That was our way of escaping the fact that we don't have any solutions to suffering. Whereas Nietzsche would suggest something like the Übermensch, the meaning of the earth, nature's natural answer to the problem of suffering is that imagine a character so strong that he didn't suffer as much. Because fundamentally, suffering is tied to ill health and weakness. It's not some type of curse that God puts upon you. You weren't put into this world to suffer. In fact, if you take care of your health and make yourself strong, you won't suffer as much as somebody who doesn't. And this is actually a very big problem you see in the secular liberal world. You have all these depressed, overweight, losers who are full of envy and hate. They go on and they hassle all these people. They're just, you know, the disgusting leftists and libtards and communists and all these crazy motherfuckers who have gone into the modern education system and been transformed into soy cooks, soy jacks. And they're unhealthy and they're full of seed oils and they're depressed and they're running these polyamorous relationships and their girlfriend doesn't, is like sucking dicks where she's coming home to them and stuff like this. Like, you know, it's like their lives are terrible and they're at war with everything in their own nature. And they're suffering from these crippling experiences of depression. They have anxiety all the time. All these terrible things because their endocrine systems are fucked up because they're overweight. All these terrible choices leading to this compendium of like problems. And they suffer a massive amount. And then they project that suffering out onto you. And then if you're strong, you'll notice that you don't have most of these problems. You don't need to go to therapy. And you don't need to take antidepressants. If you take your take care of your diet, get plenty of sun, and straighten yourself out and be a fucking, you know, like you actually impose discipline upon your life. You don't need many of these coping mechanisms if you take care of yourself. You don't need an escape from suffering if you're not suffering. And if you actually develop enough health, most of your suffering goes away. It's not that you all of it will go away, but a lot of it will. And so this leads to this very pregnant question that should our ideal, our goal, our aim be strength instead of escapism? Is this ideal that we have of the nice guy, you know, of the sort of frail energy, is that actually that we keep in mind because it allows us to deal with suffering is actually making our suffering worse? It's like somebody worshipping an antidepressant without realizing that that's actually their problem. Whereas this idea of like vital strength would change that whole paradigm completely and make that problem go away. And so all this pain and suffering within the soyjack world is manifest as these giant nature metaphors, as these big unconscious, pregnant natural forces, like all of the pain of mankind is this sloshing ocean, this stormy ocean. All of the pain of mankind is this sloshing, stormy cloud, storm clouds. And the idea of the Übermensch is the manifestation, taking all that pain and understanding that it's just blunt energy. It's not, you can't value judge it. And you can actually direct that pain. You can give that pain a purpose. All that pain is actually something that is going to create something. And this is, of course, lightning. What does a storm create? Only lightning. And of course, that lightning is the Übermensch, is precisely what Nietzsche says. He is that lightning. He is that frenzy. And what happens when you get struck by this lightning, when this storm of agony and pain finally causes man to have this electric shock of lightning and realize, what should I become? What is my goal? How do I overcome this state? This lightning strikes you and you realize this idea of perfect strength, of superior health, of a goal, of a purpose, of something to fight for, of something to fight for that will make you more powerful, that will work. When you feel that energy inside of yourself, what happens to you? You develop not hope, but you develop vital belief. You develop frenzy. You develop this chthonic Dionysian desire to go for it. You actually believe that it can happen. It's like when somebody gives you a plan and you know that it can work. It's not hope. You start to believe. You start to say to yourself, fuck, we can do this. And then that lightning starts to electrify you and you start to develop energy and power. And all of a sudden, Zarathustra has passed on his sunballed vitalism onto you now. And now you believe. Now you're no longer a black-pilled soyjack. Now you're no longer a loser. Now you're no longer an escapist, a despiser of the body. You're somebody who says, holy shit, if we actually put our heads down and go for this, we can solve really big problems. And we can live happy and joyful in the process. That is the lightning of the Übermensch. My good God, that was some rant, you poor bastards. Any questions? Yes, I see we've got some people here. If you want to ask a question, just request. Who is yes? Give me a second. Let me check requests. Animus Foundation. Hello. Hello, hello, hello. How are you doing, sir?
Good. How are you? Happy New Year's, man.
Hey, Happy New Year's. What's going on?
So I had two questions. One of them I forgot during the long run.
Nice.
The nice second one is, don't you think we need the backdrop of like of normies and the herd to create, you know, the exceptional people? Kind of like if everyone's exceptional, nobody is, right?
Yeah, that's true. Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. I don't think, you know, I think there's an idea that Nietzsche says in the second section. I'm not sure if you're here for that, but he has Zarathustra say that he loves mankind, and he contrasts that with this saint who's basically black-pilled and jaded and hates mankind. And I think that's a really important sentiment, because like Nietzsche can kind of make you get a bit uppity with yourself. And it's like, well, you are of the people, you know? And in some sense, like a lot of us maybe reading this stuff, you tend to get this problem with Nietzsche where you think you're just some of a superior God or something like this. It's like the people are, they're part of the program. And in order to, like, look, it's kind of a, maybe a bit of a redundant talk because it might get a little bit political, but in order to understand how something like great, like the Ubermensch, would happen, it would be the will of a collective people that would be pushing towards this. Now, what would be the nature of that people might be very interesting, but it would have to come down to that in the end. Like, it has to come down to a group of people pushing in that direction at the very least. Hopefully a lot of them, but at the very least, like some group of people aiming for the heights, aiming for the high project or something like this. And if that's the case, it's going to be a team effort, you know. And that's just the problem of a really genius social organizer. It's really, really hard to do that stuff. Like, that's where it kind of gets down into the political, the true meaning of the political. But
this brings me to my second question. So don't you think this is like the ultimate psyop to create like the Ubermensch? Just put the people down as much as possible, and the ones who rise up, you know, kind of take over.
Maybe, but let me put it this way: the Spartans did not, you know, the Spartans were all focused on being powerful. Like, the Spartans were about them winning. Do you know what I mean? It was them focusing on themselves and saying, "What can we do for ourselves?"
Yeah, but and also the Spartans weren't living in a global world, I guess. They didn't have the same population as we do.
Yeah, well, we don't like necessarily live in a homogenized world. Like, we live in a global world, but not a homogenized world. The Spartans lived in the same world we do. You know, things weren't much different. The question was more like, it may be a question of scale, but it's not like we're not all the same nowadays. Like, we've got very distinct groups of people all across the world with very distinct focuses. You can even see the global order fracturing at the moment with the likes of Russia and all these type of things. And, you know, China is off doing its own thing. This is sort of what I mean by getting into this, like, is diving down into specifics. But this is also a bit of an issue I see with an awful lot of the kind of standardized thinking, that we develop very, very broad, big conceptions like globalized world, when the devil is in the details. The specifics are very, very important, you know?
Okay. Thanks, man.
No worries, my man. No worries. Any other ponderings? Any other questions? No.
It's scary.
Yeah. Oh, Mason, what's going on? Give me a second here. How are we, gentlemen? Mr. Mason. Oh, Mr. Mike as well. Good Lord. Mason or Mike? Mason has dropped down. Mike, if you want to chat. Hello, bro. What's up?
Yeah, so a pretty crazy thing, like, in the, I know you had the video about, like, SRI and, what was it, remote viewing, so one of the books SRI produced is called Changing Images of Man, and it was reviewed by, like, Joseph Campbell and folk, and the main thing was that they recognized that, like, essentially the myths of the past were, like, all based, like, on economic stuff, and so then they had to kind of recreate, like, a spiritual kind of way of like viewing things, right? And so it's just funny because, like, you look at, like, the remote viewing, all the guys in there and stuff, and it's all about, like, that spiritual kind of, like, afterlife stuff, kind of like global consciousness stuff. And then you look at the Changing Images of Man, which is, like, this big psyop that they're trying to create. And so if you consider, like, the UFO thing fake, right, like, there's this whole psyop angle that the Changing Images of Man is kind of like the playbook of how they're trying to convert us from an economic, you know, focus that's like rational and competitive and whatnot to a kind of more spiritual thing as kind of like, you know, a solution to that.
So what exactly do you mean by this? Run it by me again a bit. Because this is something I've thought about an awful lot. I've heard Giorgiani talk about this quite a bit, which is an interesting one. Because we, you know, you bang on about the Ubermensch and this image of strength or something like this. And then you have someone like Giorgiani basically saying, yeah, there's people out there who are able to read other people's minds and turn people's hearts off with their heads. And you're like, oh, bollocks. Like, that's fucking nuts. Like, what's going on with this? And are you suggesting that there's that movement has half of the people who are hyped and energized towards that, and maybe there's another half who are trying to, I don't know, take it in a different direction? Like, how should I understand that?
Yeah, so basically, like, there's two schools of thought, which is, like, you know, the UFO topic with, like, Lou Elizondo, Jim Semivan, all these Pentagon CIA guys. They either, there's two schools of thought where it's either, it's all legit, right? So there's these interdimensional aliens, like, you know, Jacques Vallée researched too, that essentially are kind of guiding humanity towards a certain focus, right? Or there's a thought that it's all a psyop and they're trying to do, like, you know, the Project Blue Beam kind of thing, right? So this is a big deal, obviously, because, you know, you have all these, you know, the Navy, you have all these people admitting that UFOs are real now. And so it's like, this is kind of the next stage of evolution, whether you want to ignore it or not, kind of thing. So the guys who researched remote viewing, which is tied into the UFO topic so much, too, because you have all these guys like Wilbert Smith, who worked for Transport Canada, you know, all these UFO experiencer accounts say that there's like a telepathic element to it. And then Ingo Swann too at SRI, he essentially said that he's, you know, remote viewed aliens on the dark side of the moon and stuff. And then all these, you know, Stanford Research Institute guys swear by Ingo Swann and his accuracy. So essentially you have is like a book published by SRI. It was called Changing Images of Man. And then it's essentially saying that, like, you know, all the myths up to this point in the American kind of experiment were based on like competitive economic capitalist models. And so they want to change things to a more kind of spiritual model. And so then it's like, it almost gives credibility to this idea that if it was a psyop, this is kind of the playbook behind that. And then this is kind of like what you're seeing in real time with the UFO topic too, is like, maybe there's inklings of truth, but then there is kind of this guiding hand, which is kind of trying to give us a new myth for the times. Right. And so, even I know Young, one of his late books was the UFO, on the UFO topic too, and he compared like the UFO to like the Mandela and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I'm actually remember reading that. It's really cool because I think his take didn't it influence what's his face? It influenced Jacques Vallée, and basically then Jacques Vallée created heavily modified the dimensional theory, and then Alex Jones actually got wind of that. And so Alex Jones' take on the UFO was actually really sophisticated as a consequence. He's basically saying, like, well, the people who seriously believe in the UFOs are actually talking about that they're these fifth dimensional entities that are projecting themselves into our reality and communicating with people. And they're like, it's just like, what the fuck, this is so crazy. But I'm not exactly sure. I'm not exactly sure the relevance to Zarathustra, for example. Are you suggesting that the UFOs are an example of a kind of myth, that a phenomenon that is real, but there's groups of people out there that are going to try grab that phenomenon and bend it and turn it into another version of the Soyjack myth, and then they're going to use it to, like, I don't know, shove a dildo up all our asses or something like this?
Or yeah, basically, that's kind of like this kind of like meta myth that they're trying to drive us towards, right?
Yeah. So you would suggest that that's one of the major ones that's coming, that like the whole UFO energy is going to be the big one. And do you believe that it's like is that going to be some type of like spin? Like, it's going to be some type of like fake psyop or something like this? And so the UFO phenomenon might be like maybe man's capacity to interact with fifth dimensional things, like his higher imagination and, you know, AI and all these things are going to open up very interesting questions regarding this. And then these people are going to come along and like distort that and turn it into something very, very soy.
Yeah, exactly. Like there was, I forget the exact person, but there was a book written called American Cosmic. Diana Pasulka. And basically she talked about how this whole UFO narrative is going to be hijacked to control people. Right. And so then that's why it's like, you have all these whistleblowers coming out and whatnot. The interesting thing is, like, you know, so there was a guy called Whitley Strieber, right? And he was in the, and you know, hopefully, everyone's connecting the dots here. I'm not just kind of rambling on UFOs here. Essentially, this is kind of the narrative hijack that's happening to control people, like as a meta myth, right? So Whitley Strieber, essentially, he was the first guy to popularize the kind of the gray UFOs with a book, because he was an abductee. But then what was later found out was Whitley Strieber, he was in like New Mexico, or the specific location and time when the CIA was doing MK Ultra. And so some people suspect it was a MILAB, a military abduction, to kind of, so he would like, you know, write this book or whatnot and all this kind of stuff, and then push the myth forward. And so it's all just interesting, because it's all like SRI, kind of CIA, they're all connected kind of like that.
Yeah, it's a very interesting question in regards to an awful lot of this stuff and how it relates to like the three letters and all these, because these big, like you'd hear Alex Jones talk about this, and I think it's quite a good point, you know, like the Bilderbergs and all this. Like they were, like the Club of Rome is a very famous one. Like they were talking about climate change decades ago, and they're setting the pre- like Nietzsche is talking about a sort of philosophical question about, all right, how do we begin to come to terms with the times that we're entering into? And he's talking about the meaning of the earth, and he's talking about this image of the Superman and all these types of things. And then you look at many of these institutions that begin to form in the 20th century, the Bilderberg Group, the Club of Rome, they grab onto these trends. I don't think they're like, you know, reading Nietzsche and enacting his plan, but they're sort of like grabbing onto the memes that he might have started and just basically bending it to their will. And there's a little bit of a worry that their will is, well, there's two possibilities, because either their will is the last man will, they themselves are Gollum. Like you look at Klaus Schwab and you realize like he's not actually Dr. Evil, he's actually just a fat loser. Like that's really what it is. And he's making these, all these plans to eat bugs because he's a dork who believes it. Bill Gates is another great example. People are like, oh, Bill Gates is out here, Nietzsche and Uberman. She's like, Bill Gates made a factory to manufacture water out of poo, and then he drank it. Like, that's a dork, man. If I've ever heard anything in my life that describes a dork, that should be the Wikipedia definition of a dork. He's not, he's a dork, man. He's a loser. And this is him getting on board with like advances in technology. But the problem is that he's just like, you know, he's just a dude who needs to get kicked. Or I shouldn't be saying that shit in the internet. Like, anyway, he's an example of that. But then there's also the spin where, are they in a Machiavelli way becoming conscious of these trends and planning for themselves? They're saying, all right, well, we're going to shove these idiots into the last man category. We're going to make them eat bugs. We're going to Fauci them up. They're going to vax the fuck out of them. And then we're going to reorganize their DNA, and we're just going to like globally cuckold them. And then we'll go and get all this life extension tech and get all the assets and get all the crypto and all this stuff. And then we'll become the Superman, the Ubermensch, you know, we'll become the Ubermensch and all this. And Alex Jones actually promotes this exact ideology, that they're consciously doing this with this malicious intention. And so there's a couple of questions then, because are they going to take things like UFOs, which might be, you could say, a natural phenomenon that maybe even has a quite a benevolent side to it, but they're going to capitalize upon that and use it to instantiate a sort of totalitarian system. It's like, we've got this existential threat, and these UFOs want to hurt you, and you're not allowed to talk to them because they're evil. We'll talk to them, and then you hide in your house and stay on climate lockdown and eat the bugs, and we'll interact with them and keep everybody safe. And then you have then the same sort of problem. And then, you know, other things will show up as well. AI is another great example. Like, what the fuck is going to happen with that shit? You know, like, God, where is that going to go? What's going to happen with that stuff? And so the story there is that these people are enacting a sort of will to power project and taking the leap forward and becoming Dubermensch type thing. And the question is like, maybe that's it. But there's also like the counterpoint, which I see a lot, is people often saying that they're not that smart. Like we have this problem, many people in the reactive space, to think that these people are some types of geniuses, where actually they're just a load of like incompetent, short-term thinking dudes who are thinking like, you know, 2 or 3 decades in advance, but definitely not like 50 to 70 years to make plans like we're talking about here. And the pandemic is a great example. People often say it's like, when that started, everybody thought it was the new world order, but now a lot of people are sort of saying actually it genuinely does look like global incompetence and just profit opportunism and like just dumbassery and stuff like this. So yeah, it's a pretty interesting question. Any further ponderings, Mike, before I...
Hello. Sorry.
Go on, yeah, Tony, go on.
So, guten Abend aus Berlin. It's I really like this this series. It's pretty long, so I have like a couple of points to react to, if it's okay.
Sure.
Yeah, I was reading Nietzsche like 2 years ago, like during the pandemic, and Jung was smoking high levels of THC, and it was amazing. And for me, actually, I think like Nietzsche is kind of like a children's book, but people take him like too seriously. So you're talking about like strong barbaric instincts that were able to overthrow Rome. And I feel like what he meant by the strong instincts were like, we do have these strong instincts that we possess as human beings, right? As you said, like from worm to human to a big question mark. And but maybe I was thinking that, as you said, Nietzsche meant more in a philosophical sense, where these strong instincts are not to be really overcome, but more to transform and be elevated. Kind of like, if I think about the Übermensch, right? I was more thinking the closest human being to Übermensch was probably like Buddha or Jesus, because they were able to create religions that would tap deeply into the subconscious of humankind and still influence it after 2,500 years and still running. So for example, the Tibetans that are surrounded by mountains, they basically still live in the dark ages, very self-sufficient, know how to hunt, know how to battle all these harsh climates. And they don't waste any time on anything that's happening in the West or the East. No concepts, nothing material. Like from day one, they focus kind of like on the spiritual world. They have like a lot of meditation exercises.
Tony.
Yeah.
What age are you?
What age I am? I'm sorry, I didn't understand your question.
I was wondering what age you were. Like, are you 20, 25?
I'm 30. I'm 1992, 2nd March, Pisces, with a lot of Aquarius influence.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. What do you do? If you don't mind me asking, maybe you don't want to talk about it.
I'm a data analyst at an influencer marketing company. But at the same time, I manage my best friends who are rappers from Prague, Czech Republic, and a photographer. Yeah, so like many things. But I feel like I'm kind of like in a peculiar position because I'm Vietnamese. I was born in Germany, but I grew up in Eastern Europe. So because of that, I'm pretty much politically incorrect, and I can say things that Germans cannot say or not allowed to say. For example, the current migration situation in Western Europe.
All right. Look, your comments on the Übermensch and all that stuff, like I get you, but I've heard it an awful lot, but I just think it's a simplistic perspective on it. Like I'd recommend you spend a bit more time reading about it, because saying that maybe the Buddha is the Übermensch or something like this, like maybe he's a great man and all this, but I like Nietzsche's pointing at a much different idea than something like that. He would suggest that these are great men, great creators, certainly Buddha and Jesus, but he just has a different perspective in the end of things. So, maybe check it out a little bit more.
Yeah, sure. Like, I will dive like more deep into it. I was like reading these books over and over and over, and I understood that you can't read Nietzsche like through your eyes. You have to really like live through his books to understand the message behind it.
Yeah. Sweet, man. Jeremy, will you have any last questions, Tony, or we'll bounce on to Mr. Jeremy?
Yeah, I would. Yeah, let's bounce to Mr. Jeremy. Yeah,
sweet, sweet, sweet. Mr. Jeremy, how are you, sir? Any pondering?
Hey, Steph, thank you so much for setting up the call. This is awesome. I love all the work you do. But yeah, actually, I had a question related to Tony's question because I thought it was really interesting, of how like the Ubermensch could be someone like a Jesus Christ or a Buddha. Because I remember in one of your videos, you were talking about the genealogy of morals, right? And how like the slave morality overpowers the master morality. And like, wouldn't you say that, and I know like the Stoics, they're really big on following their nature, and they kind of had a different interpretation of nature. So like, wouldn't you say someone who's like mentally strong is almost stronger than someone who is only physically strong? And like, isn't, like, couldn't someone like a Jesus Christ or Buddha be like not only mentally strong, but also like spiritually strong? Like, would that be an Ubermensch?
I try my best not to be sloppy with our like language and use of concepts here, because these are obviously quite difficult things to talk about. We tend to load these ideas quite a lot. So, you know, if you say spiritually strong, like what in the world does that mean? Mm-hmm. You know, like what's spiritually strong? You know, like who do we call spiritually strong? Is it your ability to endure suffering?
Mm-hmm.
Like Jesus went through a execution. Would you say he's more spiritually strong than Buddha? Maybe you could say that. Like maybe Jesus is more spiritually strong than Buddha because Buddha never went through an execution. So Buddha was never really tested doing anything hard. So Buddha's like, you know, maybe we don't know what Buddha is. Maybe he was like, you could make really horrible arguments about Buddha and say he ditched his wife when he had a kid with her. And then he ran out and started to fucking fast all the time. And then eventually settled on the middle path, which is hanging out in like, you know, hanging out in monasteries and eating nice food and just chilling and, you know, meditating all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And this sort of perspective is like, is that spiritually strong? Like that, you could argue that that's escapism, like the saint in Zarathustra. He was just cope. He was just running away from life. And this is actually what Nietzsche accuses him of. He says that Buddhism is a denial of life. It's anti-life. But it's not something that he necessarily says is evil or bad. He's just pointing out that could be, you could read it this way. You could say the same with Christianity. Like we revere Christ, of course, you know, Christ is an amazing character, but it's interesting. We obviously get emotional about it, but it's like, could you say that Christ broken the cross? He screams out right before he dies, Father, Father, why have you forsaken me? Maybe he mentally snapped at that point. Like, we don't know. Mm-hmm. And then did St. Paul come and spin this big story in order to create this countercultural movement in the Roman Empire, which he didn't like? And then beautified Christ's story and then switched around this idea that Christ was actually just a bloke who died on the cross and his prophecy didn't manifest. And then he turned it into this idea. I was like, oh, no, he didn't die on the cross. Actually, he actually rose from the dead 3 days later. And then everybody starts to believe all of a sudden in a different way. And so we have this idea then that like that's, you know, Christ is spiritually strong. It's like there's ways you can subvert that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's kind of like pernicious. I see a lot of people do it in a way that I don't like. You see like the likes of Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins be dorks about this shit. But this is like something you have to think about, you know. And then you come down to the question of like what's spiritually strong, mentally strong, I guess. Like we're kind of blending in those two things. It's like, fuck, like if you have somebody who's a successful fighter, they're very mentally strong, you know. They're very, very like, look at TJ Dillashaw in his recent UFC fight. He dislocated his shoulder in the middle of the fight and fought through it for two rounds. It's like, that's pretty mentally strong, you know, like these types of things. And you can look and find loads of examples from warrior types, people with fantastic physiques that have mental strength, because in order to get a fantastic physique, you have to kind of get to that point. And so many of these concepts just break down at that point. And then asking stuff like what's an Ubermensch is again, it just all starts to break down at that point, because you're like maybe putting the cart before the horse. I'd say the Ubermensch is, it's almost like a meditation tool, if you wish, mm-hmm. or it's like strictly it's an ideal, and saying to yourself, what would be the manifestation of the greatest strength for us? And that's really where the rubber hits the road. Like what does it mean to be powerful? How do you enhance your maxim of personal power and then extend that to your family and your people? That's really what it comes down to. And that's a very, very simple thing to begin meditating on and just implement the simple things. Like people get caught up in all sorts of crazy shit. And I'm like, well, why don't you just focus on health and nutrition and discipline and mental strength, those kind of foundational things, maybe even in a blunt athletic sense. And you can gradually work it up to like knowledge and dynamism and creative thinking and go forward from there. So yeah, there's like a lot of thinking has to go into this, and it can be a little bit of a pain in the ass sometimes.
Yeah, and I just have one more thing to say, but like I think in terms of spiritual strength, like when I think of Christ, it's like when you're encountered with like, I don't know, that energy, or you read the Bible, it has like a revolutionary effect on society. Like it's built like the chapel in the West and kind of changed culture. And even like, for example, like let's say a guy like Andrew Tate, I see him as like a guy who's like very mentally strong, but almost like in a sense, he has a spiritual strength too, because when young men like encounter that energy, they want to level up, they want to get better. And I think that's like how it, that's kind of how I would look at spiritual strength.
Okay, cool. Yeah, cool. Yeah, fair enough, man. Any last ponderings before I bounce on to the next person?
Can I have like some few ponders?
No, I'm going to let Connor speak now, my man.
Okay.
Mr. Connor.
Hello, Steph. Hello, everybody.
How you doing, man? Mr. Plato.
Yes, I'm doing well. I hope everybody else is doing well. So I have been on what I consider a spiritual path for a long time now, for many years. What I'm trying to find a good balance of is my contemplation and my body. And what I've discovered over time is that the more exercise that I do, or the more that I spend time in nature into basically this physical world, the more my contemplative powers, quote unquote, tends to get better. And my actual question is, like, should we redefine or shift into a new paradigm of how we view enlightenment? Since there's many religions and spiritual teachings that teach meekness and passivity, and how do we reconcile Nietzsche's Übermensch with the common teachings of love and kindness, assuming that love and kindness is equated with, you know, the meekness and passivity?
Yeah, well, I guess an awful lot of Nietzsche's work talks about this quite straight up. So I was talking about in this space when I was reading out those sections from Zarathustra, I was talking about how you have sort of two images of a man that you manifest. So if you live in your culture and you've got all these institutions like the education system and the food system and the media and the work system, all of these are imposing influence on the people inside of them and changing them. So you go into a school system, you're taught to sit down in the fetal position and scribble on pieces of paper, and then you learn information about, nowadays it's about like, you know, changing your gender, and then learning about like geography or whatever the fuck it is. And all these things are having an effect on the kid that's going through them. And all these things are going to transform the kid. And if you, it's like a factory machine. You run the kid through the education system. They pop out on the other end. They'll be like this golem, you know, the last man, as we would say. And you're seeing this all around you these days. The kids are stupider, weaker, frailer. They've got less going for them. Like they're fucked, you know, things are getting harder for them overall. And it's hard to see. Their attention spans are more ruined. Like, you know, it's the general complaints people have about man. Now, if you sit down and think about this philosophically, this is really what we mean by, this is what Nietzsche is trying to do. Say, why does this education system produce this character? And it comes down to the decisions that this education system, more specifically the creators and organizers of that education system, make about what is a good person. And that is a moral, that then dictates the morality after that. So the right or wrong choices to make along the line. So if you imagine that the good, the useful product of that education system is a character that can fill in Excel sheets and sit in his chair for many hours a day, well, then you're going to build an education system exactly like the one we have. So morality is downstream from your goal, from your ideal, from your end product, your intention. Do you understand? The morality comes as a result of the goal that you're aiming at. Okay. And so when you say stuff like kindness, when you say stuff like all of these type of things, these are nice, but they're sort of empty platitudes. You know, they sound great, all these type of things, but they are ultimately supposed to be judged on the end product of the systems that they are a part of. So if you go over to the Buddhist infrastructure in India, what type of people does it produce? If you look at the Christian world, after it's had 2,000 years working with Western European man, what type of man has it produced? It's the morality that it used in order to craft and shape man, because morality is a force for shaping man. What has it done to Western people? You look at liberalism. What is the morality of liberalism done to Western people? And all of them have room to be criticized. You know, obviously none of them are going to be perfect. Obviously they did good things in some ways. You know, for example, Christianity made all of Western Europe literate. Buddhism made all of Tibet wise and patient. But at the same time, they also kind of castrated them a little bit. Nietzsche complains that Christianity, through its goal of basically turning everybody into the pious semi-celibate monk, has turned everybody in Western Europe into a little bit of a book coper, a little bit of a moral fanatic, a little bit of a somebody, like basically the kind of beginning stages of what we have now, which is the neurotic, stuck in their head, over heavy thinking golem that we see so much, that denies their body, that we see around ourselves so much nowadays. Buddhism is the same thing. Buddhism has many problems where it's not necessarily a religion that can cultivate the energy of a warrior. That it's kind of at odds with this. It's a bit of an escape from life in many ways. You know, of course it can work in some ways. It's not, this is not binary or black and white, but generally speaking, it's not designed as this infrastructure to build something like this. Whereas if you look at the systems, the education systems that produce strong people, I keep using the Spartans because they're just a premier example, these tend to be an awful lot more effective at producing powerful people. And you always see that their morality is much, much, much harsher. They don't have these concepts of kindness. In fact, they are antagonistic to things like kindness. Why is this? Well, it's because nature doesn't value those things that much. These are beautiful ideals. They sound really nice. And I'd like people to treat me with kindness, you know, but they don't necessarily exist in nature in the way we think they are. And so they're sort of got a problem, because if you want to be strong, you want to be vital, you want to be creative, you want to be healthy, you have to interact with nature. Nature is the source of all of those things. And the more you drift away to these sort of more socially lubricant systems like Buddhism or Christianity or liberalism, if you will, the more you come away from that, the weaker you become, but the nicer you become. And so you have to sit down and be able to make these judgments on these things and think about them. And this is when you say stuff like meek, this is what you're getting into. So I think the simplest thing I could say to you, because, you know, I'm not going to sit here and try to explain to you why something like Christianity is wrong. It's far too pretentious for me to cast judgment on an entire religion. But think about this logic, this philosophical logic. You think of the mathematics of philosophy or morality here if you want. Don't think about morality. Okay, put that aside for a second. Put aside meek and kind. And think about this equation. The goal, which is the man it produces, how does that relate to the morality that it promotes? Because we have this weird habit where we fetishize morality. Again, this is sort of a legacy of Christianity. But if you put morality aside, you put this aside the decision, all right, and think about the goal. Why are you making the decision? This is actually reasoning from first principles. What's your intention? Don't just decide that something's right or wrong because everybody else says it is, or because you're told that kindness is good or kindness is bad. Don't decide any of that stuff. Instead, ask yourself, end results, products. I want to, what's the vision of the most beautiful, glorious, and best person you can imagine? You know, get towards that. What would that look like? Like, obviously, you're going to say somebody who's healthy, strong, powerful, strong immune system, vital, lives long, creative, intelligent, dynamic in their speech. You know, you can even add in virtues if you want, like charitable, generous, soulful. Like, these, there's nothing wrong with this stuff. But you're imagining this Superman, this incredible person who has all the superhero traits. And then once you get to that conclusion, you have to ask yourself, well, how does that person become that person? And then you're going to get faced with some harsh realities. Like, you're not going to be able to become something like that unless you outcompete everybody else, unless you become strong and physically strong. And you have to do all sorts of incredible things that you're going to have to do to go beyond yourself. And this is going to be very challenging, because most of the things that we cherish, like our morals, will just crumble in our hands at that point, because they just don't suit our goals. Because if they did, we would be that thing. And instead, we're not. Right now, Western Europe is a fucking, you know, the West is a mess because of our incorrect moral decisions. So I'll leave it at that. Any last ponderings? I might wrap it up at this point, Jens. It's fucking late at night right now.
Thank you for answering my question, though.
No, not at all, man. Not at all. Thank you for asking the question.
Quick caveat before you depart. Don't you think these ideologies sort of have like an expiration limit? Because, I mean, the Romans and everything, their ideology gave birth to like decadent people as well in the fall of Rome and whatnot. So, like, do they have some sort of like half-life period where they just become like weaker as ideas? Same with Christianity. I mean, the Crusades were not really meek, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, again, from Nietzsche's idea, which is an interesting idea, he would assert that Rome, Christianity, like all of these things, I guess this is probably his greatest challenge to Christianity. He's not like crazy anti-Christian, but he's pointing out a very interesting question. It's that ideology has nothing to do with it. You know, like, ideology makes fuck all of a difference when you actually look at it in the conclusion. In fact, he says this in Twilight of the Idols, the body is the first principle. Anybody who does not start a culture from the body fails at making culture. And they always will, because this is just the way the world works. And if you deny the body, you get your first principles wrong at the out and you fuck up entirely. Okay, now that is definitely a paraphrase for what he says, but it's along those lines. End of Twilight of the Idols. Now, why he says this is because you see this constant thing where ideology never saves a people, never works. No ideology is godsend. No ideology changes anything, ever. So, for example, with Christianity, Christianity rose and became vital and powerful in the West, and the West conquered all of the world as Christians. And now Christianity has crumbled and fallen. Why? Rome rose to power with the vital pagan religions, and then it took over all of the world, and then eventually it fell. Why? So it seems that the ideology can't really save a people. Like, Rome transformed, became Christian, and it rose up in power briefly, and then it fell again. So Christianity didn't save it. As I said, Islam is the same thing. The Arabs became Muslim. They almost took over Western Europe. They made it to France. Then they crumbled and fell themselves. Why? Why does it happen this way? It's because the first principle is not the ideology. Doesn't matter if you're Christian or if you're Muslim, if your soul is weak, if you're lacking vitality, you're not going to make it. It's not going to work. The reason why Rome fell is because the people got decadent in their spirits. You know, they got too rich, all sorts of natural processes that you see. They started off vital, Martian, following the pagan gods. The pagan gods are actually an expression of their vitality. Then when they became powerful, you notice this in an awful lot of their writings, their pagan gods start to become more rationalized and more sterile as a consequence. People are talking about how the pagan gods are sort of like, you know, metaphors and stuff like this. And then eventually they're basically falling into ruin soon after that, because their vitality has left them. Yeah, so their vitality has left them at that point. So the same happens with Christianity. You know, Christianity, the West becomes powerful alongside Christianity. It has vitality in its soul. The people are strong. The people are healthy. They're the barbarians from the old German Roman Empire, the old Germans outside the Roman Empire. But then when these Western people become weak, Christianity becomes weak alongside them. And you see this very clearly in the last 100 years. As the West has fallen, Christianity has fallen. And it's a very interesting question. You see an awful lot of people all over the place now saying that the cause of the West's fall was the death of Christianity. And this is like the likes of even Jordan Peterson saying this stuff. And Nietzsche just has a very interesting point to make. It's like Christianity didn't fall. We fell. We lost our vitality. And you could maybe blame things like the education system or the mistakes of Greek philosophy for convincing us to build institutions that don't promote vitality. But as much as you want to say that, it's not necessarily there's much you can do about it, you know? So the first principle is really what you're looking for. And that comes down to the creation of health and strength inside the people's bodies in general. And if you wanted to build it, like Nietzsche's basically proposing, if you built an ideology on that first principle, what would you have? You know, and that's what he would call a life-promoting religion. And that's not religion, really, but like life-promoting perspective and attitude. And that's what he considers the intelligent thing to do. And this is sort of what he means by this idea of going beyond all the religions of the past. And, you know, all the gods are dead. We're moving into the new era and all this type of stuff. And Richard Dawkins reads that and goes into the bathroom and has a wank because he thinks like it's like he's going to sell more books or something like that. But it's not actually what Nietzsche means at all. So that would be the perspective on that. It's like ideology, not really that big of a deal. You're like the things we say inside of our heads and we declare inside of our heads don't have that big of an influence on the world compared to the power inside of our souls, our spirits, you know, that type of thing. All right, gents, I will give it a wrap then if there's no last... Oh, yeah, sorry. Everybody muted. I'm going to give it a wrap now because I'm pretty much tuckered out at this point. But, yeah, thank you for dropping in. Go on, Jeremy, are you going to say something?
I was just curious if you have time for one more question.
Yeah, go on, shoot. I'll have to see the length of the question. Okay. Absolutely.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Steph. But I guess, like, let's say... in the West, like the Western male, like you see a guy who has a lot of anxiety and is kind of like lacking, you could say like lacking in his soul. what do you think the advice, what are like the simplest ways to like reverse that according to Nietzsche?
Would you say that again? If someone's lacking a soul?
Yeah. Like how could someone, like what's the solution for like the Western male? I guess that's my question.
Yeah. It's not rocket science. Like it's as profound as Nietzsche might seem, he's not complicated. You know, like it's like, how do you create strength? Here's a very good example of it. It's like, what type of influence does the hormone testosterone have in your mind? Actually, a shockingly profound one. Like the higher your testosterone is, the calmer you are in making decisions, the better you are at handling anxiety, the better looking you are. All sorts of crazy shit happens as a consequence of this stuff. Same with all your other hormones. And so, like, would you have a dramatic change on a people if you could raise their testosterone? Yes. And you could go about that by, you know, injecting them all with fucking TRT or something like that. But actually, just getting them to hit the fucking gym and eat clean would make a big difference. You know, if, like, if you wanted to instantiate a Nietzschean program, it would look like a society run by health freak biohackers. That's probably the place it would start. And this would actually be a genuine way to get the good. What's funny is that it's not that romantic. It's not like something where you're talking about some type of great political thing, but instead it'd be like, all right, how do we sit down and go through the logistical supply chain of the food system to make sure that we're no longer having seed oils show up in everything? How would we go? Like, you know, something you could do is go into McDonald's and say you're no longer allowed to use sunflower oil and fill people's veins with polyunsaturated fat because that disrupts their endocrine system. You're now going to cook in beef tallow. And you're going to do all this type of stuff. And it's like, that would absolutely revolutionize society within 10 years. It would be insane if we did that, you know? You would get rid of high fructose corn syrup. You would do stuff like take a look at economics and sort of say to yourself, well, what's the incentives here for people to be scamming people with big capital and stuff like this? You would go into the education system and you'd be like, all right, no more Adderall. And kids only have to go for 2 hours of education. We're going to instantiate public speaking and rote memorization. We're going to get them to use AI and computers and experiment with this stuff. And then we're going to get them to do athletic performance as well. And so you just kind of revolutionize things. You'd stop training people to be office drones assuming you wanted to stop doing that, you would, you know, maybe work on a bit more problem solving in these types of situations. Maybe you'd set up institutions that would harvest out the high IQ people from across the West, and then you would start to shut down normal schools because they're just all cope and shit anyway, and there's no real actual use. There's all sorts of questions you have to kind of come into it and try to figure out what you're going to do. But that's basically what it would look like. You'd be like trying to reorganize things from the question of how do you promote health and vitality at the foundational level, you know, like energy, mitochondrial energy, you know, get better nutrition. These really boring, basic things would probably have the biggest effect. There's an old famous saying from Napoleon where he said that an army marches on his stomach. And it's that type of question, like these big, profound things that we want might come down to stuff like how are we dealing with our cattle herds and shit like this, you know, really boring things like that. But that's the actual stuff that would drive a change.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think like we're definitely missing that. Like the food quality is really poor.
Yeah. It's really bad, man, because it's so elegant and simple, but it's just like so difficult to execute upon because there's just so much entrenched perspectives, and it's just not that romantic. It's not like some sexy political project like own the libs or, you know, stop abortion or something like that. Like it just doesn't evoke those massive emotions like those things do. And so that's a big issue. It's a very, very big issue because, like, if you look at the depression crisis, or you look at the ugliness crisis, or the fat cell crisis, or the incel, like you look at all these crises that are going on, they're very downstream from things like poor nature. Like we're like, why is everybody ugly? Why is everybody fat? Why is everybody depressed? All these problems are happening because we have really difficult, deeply entrenched problems with things like logistical supply chains, incentives, bad mythological stories about, right, how to, like, you know, going vegetarian and stuff like this. And we'd have to try flip all those stones over and transform everything. And it'd be huge. It'd be monumental effort on all these specifics that we'd have to do. And it'd be very, very hard, but it would have an effect. You'd clear up an awful lot of the SSRI drones that walk around our society nowadays if you could instantiate some type of imposition on restaurant chains and McDonald's that they have to use beef tallow, for example. It's weird, but these types of things would have very big rippling effects.
Mm-hmm.
But It'd be a lot of work. It'd be very hard. There'd be a lot of political entrenchment, but it would work. And that's what's important about it. And that would give you the kind of vision of what it'd be like. And then on the flip side, if you wanted to think about, you know, maybe what Nietzscheans could do, they could go and start to think about how they would reorganize things like the pharmaceutical industry and start to say stuff like, how could we maybe make anabolic steroids more available to people within intelligent use and stuff like this, make peptides more available to them, make longevity tech more available to them. And then, you know, kind of helping the people achieve great health would be a really, really big part of that project. That would be one of the biggest foundational things, figuring that stuff out, setting up logistical supply chains for farmers. You'd probably have to clean up stuff like usury an awful lot, and that would be quite a dramatic fight to try sort that one out. So there's an awful lot of things that you have to look at. So it's a great question though.
All right, thanks so much, Steph.
not at all. All right, gents, I'm gonna give it a wrap, I'd say, but all right, I'm gonna give it a wrap. I'm absolutely wrecked. I'll talk to you later, lads.
Thank you.
Have a good one. Bye bye.